Action Safety Event, Valhan Cyclovir, and Nippon Heart Transplant Plant recipients less than 4 months of age. Basically, what they're doing is they're taking these kids, once they get the transplant, standard of care is to give them Cyclovir, which is an IV medication. They tend to give that over the course of, I think it's a week, 10 to 14 days. And then, Cyclovir for 10 to 14 days. And what this, the standard of care, what they do is they give Valcyte, which is what this is. And it's an oral drug. After the 10 to 14 day course, they normally give a 3 month cycle. I think all this is looking at is the pharmacokinetics and seeing if there's any described side effects. We use this basically off label on all our transplant patients because, as is most medication, for children, it's not approved by the FDA, even though that's where it's most effective. So what they're doing is, once they get signed up, they collect some blood tests. They do it before they give the medication, a day or two after, and then a week after the second dose of the medication. Now, the thing that's not clear to me, let me back up. They're going to take them off IV medication for 2 days before they start the oral medication to do this study. And then, but I don't understand, based on their current protocol, where this is going to fit in. Because they don't say anything about whether they're going to continue it. I mean, if their standard of care is given this anyway, I don't know why they just don't, check the blood levels and go. But I'm not really clear as to how they're exactly going to be doing that. So as far as the consent goes, so all these kids are going to be newborns or within four months of age. They only want two patients. It's a multi-center trial. I expect that's going to, with the amount of newborn we're doing, small babies we're doing, that's probably going to be, two's probably all we're going to be getting in that age range. So they do describe a medicine on the front page of the consent. They describe giving it intravenously, but then they talk about Valcyte being a similar medicine which can be taken by mouth. And again, I think they ought to make it clear right off from the get-go. We do this standard. Okay, what we're trying to look at is to see what the efficacy of this is actually going to be, and they don't really explain that.
Is that something we can stipulate?
Yes, absolutely. Oh yeah, I'm going to approve it. This is just stuff that I just wanted to clarify. On the second page, they talk about how they're going to get it. Well, most of these kids, after surgery, before they go on the Valcyte, they have some reliance for about a week. And I have a feeling for the vast majority of them, they're going to get it through the central line. Well, they say that, but then they come back and they say, well, it's going to be maybe that or a heel stick, like two paragraphs down. Well, 4 month old, I don't know if heel stick's exactly a wise thing to do, but then on the next page, they talk about drawing them peripherally and pain with that, under the side effects. So I think they'll just make it clear. Look, it's going to be one of three ways. It's either going to be through the vein, through a pre-existing central line, through an IV, through a needle stick or a heel stick. They're automatically on Ganciclovir for 2 weeks, 10 to 2 weeks, 10 days, 2 weeks, and then they get switched to Valcyte. That's what their standard is anyway right now. Okay. As far as the side effects, I don't think we need to know what the adult side effects are for Comonbol. But the children's side effects are fairly well known, since this is frequently used, even though not approved. I was very confused by having them put the kidney problems right off the top, because I think that that kind of threw things off. I would put the common side effects first, list them, and including changes in blood levels, because actually neutropenia and anemia are fairly common. It's one thing they tend to follow, because they will stop the medication if that happens. It does respond after you stop it. I think they need to make that clear that while they're doing this, they're still monitoring for this stuff anyway, and that should be clarified in the consent. And then they can throw the kidney potential for kidney problems in there and say, yeah, we'll just monitor stuff like we normally do, which is their standard. And then that's it. The number they have for referral is the transplant line. It's a good line. They can get a hold of the either Dr. Chinnick or Dr. Schenkel anytime, basically. And with those changes, I would say approve it at minimal additional. And it does have some benefit, I think. The drug itself has some benefit.
That doesn't involve them in the study.
No. So I don't know how we're going to word that then.
You can call it moderate increase over minimal risk.
Okay.
You just can't call it minimal.
I don't know what they, I can't remember what they call it. You know, guys change the terminology like every week.
And I'm not even sure if we can do it like that. The minor increase over minimal requires direct benefit.
Yeah, see, what they checked was greater than minimal but holds the prospect of direct benefits. Theoretically, it does, but they're also already doing it off-label.
Yeah.
So I guess under a medical legal standpoint, if you're, you know, if you want it as an FDA-approved drug, yes, that's
going to be good.
But so the kids are going to be getting the medication exactly the same way whether they're approved the study or not.
Right.
The only difference is you're going to follow the lab.
Basically.
Even from the
medicine.
Right.
So it's more of an observational study than anything else.
It's just the blood draws.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really...
There's
no added... And again, they don't really clarify that because they don't talk about what their standard therapy is here at Loma Linda.
But do we commonly follow levels in kids anyway?
Yeah.
No, you're not going to follow... You're going to follow liver functions and CBC.
That's true for a variety of drugs, and it changes quite rapidly in the first year of life. So it does have value.
You figure out a milligram per kilo of Captopril that I give a baby compared to an adult, it's just monstrous. It can kill the adult.
It tastes a little better.
So this actually could be a benefit to a particular recipient if you are able to figure out what the...
benefit to the population.
It's, population.
It's not a direct benefit to the...
We don't need to belabor it because it's okay.
But anyway, 1 year.
Oh, it's a
study staff received payment. It says the study sponsor, Hoffman LaRoche, is paying the study doctor and staff for their work in this study. That's a little different than some of the others I've read, such as on the one we're reviewing today. It's a lot more bland. Investigators receiving financial support to conduct the study. Is there any concern about making it? I mean, I almost think that's going to maybe detract a little bit from people participating. It's like, oh, we're paying the doctor to do this study.
I know, that's not really what they're doing. They're reimbursing for, they're not really paying.
Well, yeah, it's mostly coordinator pay.
If it suppresses enrollment, it's their problem to amend it. So
okay, great.
I don't really care.
And what about this form? What is this form? Breastfeeding, mother data, authorization form?
That's because they want to know what drugs the baby's getting through breast milk. If mom's on a medication, they need to know about it.
Okay, so is it okay?
That's what it is.
You should have been your classmate.
Oops.
Okay, any other discussion? Okay, let's vote.
Yes, I want to talk today about financial incentives in research, and I need to fess up. I'm breaking the rules. Well, not really rules, it was a guideline. When I agreed to do this, I forget if it was Dr. Zuccarelli or Dr. Rigsby that suggested that I have only one page of handout, and so that's what was sent in your packet. But I've since developed another page that I think is really important, so I'm going to go over the guideline and and hope you will indulge me. Was it one side? Oh, I didn't hear that. So I'm actually going to start with the first page of the new handout. because I'm going to state a premise on which we're discussing this issue, that the level of monetary compensation influences the participant sample, which in turn requires a payment schedule that draws individuals from different income strata into given research projects. So what might induce somebody to participate as a research subject? I mean, some people really, truly are altruistic and they want to do it for the good of society. Some people have medical needs that might or might not be addressed by the protocol. But then the third one, and the one on which we want to focus today, is non-medical gains. And an article that I read listed several excitements, social interaction, curiosity. I don't know how many people sign up for those reasons, but financial gain for assuming some risk or inconvenience, I think, is a potential motivator. And it's been noted in the literature that research budgets increasingly are showing line items for remuneration of subjects. Now, I think it's fair to say that it's really a spectrum of this inducement, from fair compensation to undue inducement to coercion. But I raise the question, is money really coercive? Because in my mind, coercion implies some threat. If you don't do this, something bad's going to happen to you. So I would compare this in my mind to the criteria for valid consent for treatment, where a physician may educate the patient, may even try to persuade them to undergo this recommended treatment, or could potentially manipulate, which we don't allow. Manipulate means to overemphasize the benefits and understate the risks. And then we go on to coercion, which is really pretty uncommon if we stick to the definition of coercion being a threat of harm. But the borderline between coercion and undue influence is pretty difficult to define. We could use the, what was the movie? The Godfather example of an offer that you can't refuse, or one that leads you to make an irrational decision. That's a value-laden term, but irrational means that you're going against your own values. Or one that leads you to do something you wouldn't otherwise do, or something that clouds your judgment. So this is really fairly gray, and it's hard to draw lines. Now, this has been addressed in some of the regulatory documents that we look to. The Nuremberg Code focuses on coercion. You remember that the genesis of that was after the horrific research that was done in the death camps by the Nazi researchers. And that code says potential participants, quote, should have the legal capacity to give consent, should be situated as to be able to exercise free power of choice without the intervention of any element of force, fraud, deceit, duress, overreaching, or other ulterior motive, other ulterior form of constraint or coercion. But the more recent document, the Belmont Report, which was looking at research in more contemporary terms, adds undue influence, which they say occurs through an offer of an excessive, unwarranted, inappropriate, or improper reward or other overture in order to obtain compliance. Also, inducements that would ordinarily be acceptable may become undue influence if the subject is especially vulnerable. And we could include there somebody who is really poor, and you offer an inducement of $100 to participate in research, which might not influence some of us, but very well might induce somebody who, for whom $100 is a big deal. Now, Dickert and Grady, two of the authors of the study that we're going to look at in the main handout, they did a follow-up study in 2002, an empiric study, asking researchers what was their reason for offering money to subjects. And most of them listed the time involved, the inconvenience, travel, and maybe a third of them, the risk involved. But these investigators found very little documentation about payments, and only about a third of institutions had any guidelines for appropriate payment. So then skipping back to our primary handout, the issues that we need to put in front of our face as we're looking about inducements for research subjects are that your job, one of your jobs, is to protect subjects from exploitation. That is, this undue influence, whatever that means. And recognizing that payment may lead to poor people bearing a disproportionate risk or burden of research, and that may actually distort the sample. And the IRB must protect the integrity of research. Payment changes the relationship of the subject and investigator from scientific to commercial. And the IRB should allow equitable access to the potential benefits of research. So we shouldn't exclude people because the protocol is going to require them missing work or whatever. So payment is common and controversial, and there really is no consensus and no federal guidance that I could find. So a little bit of history on this. Most of the literature looking at this has appeared between 1970 and 2000. I found only a few things after that date. But there is an evolved practice that we pay healthy subjects, but we don't pay patients, because the healthy subjects, because patients are especially vulnerable and they have the potential to benefit from the study. So we generally look for altruism in patients or self-interest from gaining access to the potentially beneficial protocol. Now, there's an analysis that I found of reasons, and I'm actually a little embarrassed to present this to you because I've never heard of anybody using this third option that they propose. But I think it's a good taxonomic way to look at things. But these authors, three authors, Dickert and Grady and Ezekiel Emanuel was in there too, I think, identified two models of financial compensation for subjects, and then they proposed a third. So the three examples that they offer are the reimbursement model, generally used for unhealthy subjects who might benefit. This is you reimburse them for costs of participation, time, travel, and maybe even lost wages. I mean, if it's going to take them time away from work to participate, you may compensate them for that. And it's based on altruism. And it's revenue neutral. There's no financial sacrifice for participation and no financial gain. No prospect for profit, and avoids the problem of undue influence. Then there's the market model, generally used for healthy subjects or those who will not benefit from the research. And you pay what it takes, what's necessary to recruit the volunteers, based on supply and demand or on a libertarian approach. And if the protocol is fairly easy to recruit, then you don't have to give them very much. But if it's difficult to recruit, you give them more compensation. It's an incentive for subjects who might not otherwise volunteer. And some protocols, as you have seen, will pay subjects either just a completion bonus or, in addition to compensation, pay them a bonus if they complete the entire study. Now, the third model that these authors proposed in 1999, they called the wage payment model, in which they proposed a standard rate for all subjects based on the principle of justice. And then the question is how much to compensate. And they really worked hard at trying to outline some parameters. And they say participation generally doesn't require skill, so the compensation should be based on time and should be an approximate wage for unskilled but essential labor. With a bonus for the burdens of participation, and might include a small completion bonus. And so maybe you have seen some protocols that use this or have heard of some institutions that have established guidelines like this. I have not. But I think thinking of it in these ways, especially the two paradigms of reimbursement or the market model, helps a little bit in sorting these out. And on the back of that page, I listed advantages and disadvantages, and I don't intend to read all these. I hope you have already or will have time to do that. But these authors concluded that the reimbursement model is too restrictive, the market model is too loose, and so they proposed this wage payment model. And I listed some two or three articles from the journal IRB, which looks at more of the conceptual issues involved in this. So that's really all I could find on this in the literature and the little bit of thinking I've done on my own. And I would open it up for discussion and see what do you look at when you're reviewing a protocol? What do you look at in relation to compensation? Taking the ordinary as the norm or the standard. Okay?
Sponsor, profit potentially generated from the sponsor, drug or whatever.
think that's a valid observation, that from depending on how the research is funded, whether it's a government-funded or commercial funding or no funding, that it may have different implications for the investigator. I would turn it around and ask, well, from the subject's perspective, is there a difference? And a subject being asked to participate, probably most of them don't care how the research is being funded. Some of them may. But their own decision of whether to participate or not probably depends on whether they're just going to be reimbursed or whether they're going to get some compensation and how much risk and so on. So I think that's a valid thing to look at, and I think that the IRB should look at that very closely to see if there is some undue influence. And
would you be uncomfortable if the pharma supported studies in compensating the participants in stock?
Oh, I think I'd be uncomfortable with that, yes.
If you ask someone who's participating, if you ask someone who's participating in a study whether they did it for the money and they say yes, what's the difference between that and coercion?
Hmm.
In that case, are all blood banks guilty of coercion and they pay people to come in and give blood?
Do they pay them or just give them a cheese sandwich?
Some air.
Like 60 seconds to answer it. I'd like to. It's germane. In the old days, we used to pay people to donate blood. Right. And in the modern times, if we had had the sort of Google back then, we would have been able to show that the distribution of liquor stores was actually very proximate to the donor centers.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I think it can be a little bit touchy sometimes mm-hmm. to ask a question, but I do think people should be reimbursed for being studied. I mean, everyone else is reimbursed. It's an industry, and mm-hmm. they're contributing valuable time, especially the industry sponsored.
I would agree, and then if the issue of coercion, which is always going to be there as long as it isn't egregious, I don't see how you can get around that. I think the more disrupting form of coercion is the reimbursement to investigators.
Mm-hmm.
Institutions now are grabbing on to inventions, new drugs, and so on, and wanting compensation for their institution.
Right.
There's almost an institutionalization of investigator coercion. Mm-hmm. And that's been new in the last 10 to 15 years.
Right, right. And if we agree, and I think I'm hearing this from the few who have spoken, that it's not unreasonable to compensate research subjects, should we as an institution, or should we as a research enterprise have some more formal guidelines than usual and customary?
Mm-hmm.
right?
Because I think if we as an institution are looking at this as a market type, or we're getting involved in these types of new infrastructure, we have other interests.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think the reimbursement of the investigators or the institution is a bigger problem. But
the most controversial thing we ever did in this IRB was about 10 years ago when we approved the perchlorate study. Some of you remember that. We were giving people rocket fuel to see if it caused any noticeable effect on the climate. And the reimbursement for it was $1,000. And it was a toxicity study, but it was at extremely low doses.
Are they still enrolled?
No. Well, all you have to do is go out and stick a tube down in the San Bernardino aquifer and get yourself a dose. Actually, you get more perchlorate from standard lettuce than from the water. Because lettuce in the Imperial Valley is known to concentrate perchlorate in the groundwater 100-fold. So if you're pregnant and don't want a hypothyroid cretin baby, you probably shouldn't eat lettuce. We got in trouble for that because it was a toxicity study, and we apparently didn't go through the right motions to protect. Because when you're giving something with absolutely no therapeutic intent, and you're essentially testing toxic, see whether typical exposure levels are toxic or not, you have to jump through some certain hoops that we didn't do. That was before my time, so it was probably a couple of years ago.
But the coercion issue there was no benefit, and these people had to come in over and over and over and over again for monitoring.
Right.
So the amount per visit was in the market. It was kind of a market-based model.
And it was, but where it ran afoul was one of my rules is don't get between somebody and their benefits. Don't stand between someone and their whatever benefits they get from the government. There were a group of people suing the manufacturers that had dumped the perchlorate in the groundwater. And if this study came out saying that the typical exposure levels were safe, it would have eroded their damages. So, they basically came out in force. The environmentalists came out and started picketing and all this kind of stuff about how, we're participating in this whitewash of corporate malfeasance. And anyway, so it became very political. And just don't do that.
If I could take 1.5 more minutes on the back side of the handout from today, as you may recall, I had initially handed out a list of potential topics, and one of the topics that was requested by several people was financial incentive to recruitment. And I'm running out of time to cover all the things we wanted to, and I couldn't find much on this. So I'm just bringing to your attention this one study, only one study, a retrospective study that looked at two research studies done in the same NICU that had identical enrollment criteria, and the enrollment recruitment was done by respiratory therapists in both studies. And in one study, they were given financial compensation for each baby that enrolled. In the other study, they were not. The parents were not compensated in any way, and they were not aware of the financial aspects of recruitment, and they could only be in one trial, and they didn't even know that another trial was going on at the time. The two trials had to do with babies who were about to be weaned off a ventilator, and one was a medication study, a placebo-controlled study, and the other was a ventilator strategy study. Interestingly, the respiratory therapists approached 61% of the parents who were eligible for the study where they got compensation. But they only approached 17% of the eligible parents when they were not getting compensation. Now, you can't take, oh, but interestingly, the number recruited in each study was about the same. But their approach was markedly different. Now, it could be that parents shied away from a placebo-controlled study because they wanted their infant to have the advantage of medication. and it could be that parental acceptance of the medication trial was less good than for the strategy trial. Or maybe the respiratory therapists were more comfortable talking about medication, or excuse me, talking about ventilator strategy than they were about medication. So there are several possible explanations, but I think the numbers are at least significant and perhaps impressive. So that's the only thing that I could find on the financial incentive for recruitment. And still, I've got the basic gut feeling that you shouldn't pay a recruiter very much for recruiting studies, for recruiting subjects, because this will influence them, perhaps even allow them to, in their mind, change the enrollment criteria or push the margins out a little bit and so on. So it's just another aspect of financial inducement. When I was chiefing the family medicine residents here a century or two ago, some pharmaceutical rep had approached the residents themselves, offering inducements to enroll people in a phase four study, post-marketing study. And really, it was they were trying to sell their antihypertensive, and residents had to do was fill out a 3x5 card on three different visits once the patient was started on this, and then after they got five patients, they got a free textbook. And when I heard about that, I raised a few questions and got stopped. I mean, it was a very expensive antihypertensive that could have been easily replaced with atenolol. I haven't seen it, but as I looked through the literature at this question, I think it would be a good study.
It would be great if people's idea of inducement was take it or leave it.
Yeah.
That would be clearly
right.
Yeah, if it's $1 million, we'll do an administrative review.
It'd be the first in line. So the topic that's next on the list is shutting down a study when harm is discovered. And I'm having trouble finding much on that, so I'll probably be in touch with the two of you to see what the rules are. And
well, you can double it up with another low volume
I might do that, yeah.